The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
It's at The Letters for Wednesday, January 11th on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, it's been a few weeks, but I remembered how to do the intro.
Yeah, it's been a while, eh?
Yeah. And the Jays have done nothing.
Yeah.
They have done nothing. What have you done over the last 4 weeks?
Took a little bit of time off over the holidays, and then I've been kind of mapping things out a little bit as far as where they go, but that's probably the extent of it. I mean, I'm assuming we have a busy month ahead, because otherwise this offseason just doesn't make much sense.
January 11th, pitchers and catchers report on February 15th.
Yeah.
I want to say. So yeah, you got about 35 days, I guess. If I'm doing the math correctly, I'm probably not, but like a lot has to happen.
Yeah.
There isn't a team.
And to be fair, I mean, that's 5 weeks. So there is time to make moves, but they haven't happened yet. That's for sure.
I shouldn't say there isn't a team, because there is a team, but that team features like Ezekiel Carrera playing, you know, right field, probably Melvin Othon Jr. in left field, whichever way you want to go with that. It features AJ Jimenez as your bullpen catcher. It features backup catcher. Excuse me. I'm rusty, man. It's been a while. I'm rusty. It features like several of our listeners probably as bullpen arms.
Yeah.
Right? Can you throw?
Yeah.
You're needed.
Yeah. John Corbin Music, second lefty out of the pen.
I can't confirm that he throws left-handed. I don't know. I'm sure he'll tweet us and let us know. So yeah, much work to be done for the Toronto Blue Jays. But look, we scraped together some things to talk about today.
Just, sorry to cut you off before we move on, but yeah. I wanted to ask if this was it. And it's obviously not. But if this was it for the offseason, how many wins would you project this team to four in 2017?
I believe Fangraphs has them projected currently at 82. And I would say that's probably accurate.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Give or take, you know, three or four. Yeah. So, you know, like I could see them going down to 78 or 79, or I could see them getting lucky and getting up to 85, maybe even 86. But certainly not something that I would call a playoff team on paper going into the season.
Agreed.
Yeah, where would you put them?
Yeah, I was going to say 82, 83. So yeah. That sounds about right. Right. And so that means that they're within reach of being a playoff team. You know, if you add a couple solid players and fill in around the margins a little bit, add some depth, then you have a team that should be contending for that wild card. And now we just have to see how those moves end up looking in the course of the next 5 weeks.
Right. I mean, it's a good team. Like it's a great rotation, which I think that, you know, you should expect it to regress a bit from last year. Maybe somebody's going to get hurt. But when you're, you know, I don't know if a lot of teams can line up, you know, young, good pitching like Aaron Sanchez and Marcus Stroman, you know, dependable veteran arms like Jay Happ and Marco Estrada, and then a five in Francisco Liriano, who, you know, sometimes he's masterful, sometimes he's a bit iffy with his command, but still a very, very respectable number five. So it's good rotation. You still got Thump in the lineup. Like, you know, Josh Donaldson, MVP 2 years ago, still plays for this team. Troy Tulowitzki, who is a generational talent, plays for this team. Kendrys Morales, who, like, I know Blue Jays fans haven't really gotten to meet him yet, but absolutely barrels the ball. And it's going to be a rough go probably for him in his first year, just with fan expectations. And he's going to be compared to Edwin Encarnacion the whole time. But you look at the exit velocities, he hits the ball harder than Encarnacion. He hits the ball harder than Josh Donaldson on average. I mean, this guy barrels it. And then he's still got, you know, kind of, you know, intriguing young pieces like, a Devin Travis up the middle and Russell Martin behind the plate. You know, it's still a good team. There's just some very obvious gaps around the fringes that absolutely need to be addressed and need to be filled. And I think that if the Blue Jays went out today, added an outfielder, added a dependable backup catcher, added a couple bullpen arms, I think we'd be singing a much different tune.
Yeah, agreed. And yet the fact remains that right now, this is why there's a lot of angst, I think, among a lot of fans that this team doesn't look that great at this moment. And we've gotten used in the last year and a half to watching a Blue Jays team that has been somewhere between very good and great. So it is a bit of a mental adjustment. And now they're faced with some real gaps on this club.
I'm starting to come around on the angst. Like, I'm starting to get it.
Sure.
I think that even if you're a reasonable, rational fan at this point, like, I think you have reason to be like, ooh, like, this doesn't look good. This has been a tough offseason to stomach. And I think that coming off of, like you mentioned, the last 2 years, coming off of that, Losing two franchise icons, like that's never going to be, or okay, losing one, but you're going to lose two franchise icons. Like that's never easy to take. And also just the, and I was kind of talking to you about this yesterday, I think the Blue Jays have done a really poor job of just creating positivity around their team this offseason, of managing fan expectations. And of, you know, you think about like your two primary acquisitions, you know, we could put Lourdes Gurriel aside. You know, he's a long way off. He's not going to be on the team. Your two primary acquisitions this offseason, Kendrys Morales and Steve Pierce, have been neither seen nor heard from in the public eye. But there was a conference call with Steve Pierce, a conference call with a few, whatever reporters, you know, got the message that came in a couple hours before and were able to get onto it. Kendrys Morales hasn't been heard from at all. Put these guys out there. You know what I mean? Like, and I understand there's a language barrier with Morales, and maybe there's a willingness barrier with Pierce. I don't know. I'm speculating. But like, put it in the contract or tell them, like, this is an expectation that, look, we've acquired you. You're a new piece. We need to introduce you to our fans. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate. Fly him up to Toronto for a day and stick a camera crew with him. Send him to the CN Tower. You know what I mean? Like, send him to the aquarium. Put him on the, you know, on whatever bridge is famous in Toronto or something like that. Like, get some positive PR. Bring him up. Tell a couple of people from the press who'll come out and see them and meet them. Put Steve Pierce, you know, in studio with Blair, in studio with McCowan, whatever. Do something. Like, this is, it's just money, right? This is money, easy money that you can spend to fly a guy in for the day. I remember when I'm on a tangent here, but I remember when the Raptors drafted Bruno Caboclo, who was like as much of a language barrier as you can imagine, as right. awkward with media as you can imagine, like just truly a strange human being.
Teenager too at that time,
a
right?
A teenager who had never set foot in Canada. The next day they had him in Toronto. They had a camera crew with him. Here he is looking at the CN Tower. Wow, it's so big. Here he is touring the practice facility, looking at the locker room. Hey, here's a jersey with your name on it. And you video that stuff, you Snapchat it, put it on Instagram, get a social person walking around with them, do a Snapchat takeover or whatever, answer a few questions, do something like that. Like it's this isn't hard stuff, but if you do stuff like that, you can generate some positive buzz and some positive momentum and actually introduce fans to the players that you have acquired. But I mean, Blue Jays fans have no clue who these guys are. They have not seen nor heard from them.
Yeah. No, I think that you make a lot of good points there. And one thing that makes this offseason different than, say, off seasons from 10 years ago or even 20 years ago is that baseball now, I think more than ever, is a 12-month-a-year industry.
Yeah.
And baseball fans expect baseball news 12 months a year, and they thrive on it. I mean, there's a whole industry around the hot stove and trying to keep track of what moves your team is making or not making, as the case may be. And so if you're a baseball fan, you've gotten used to this, and it works two ways too, because one person earlier this offseason, at the time that the CBA negotiations were going on, made the point to me that it's really good for baseball to be in the conversation 12 months a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, the possibility of a work stoppage at that point would have been really threatening to baseball, because if you are a league like this, you want to be in the public eye. You want to be taking up people's entertainment time, because that translates into entertainment dollars and keeps you at the forefront of people's minds. So, I think that it makes sense. If you're the Jays, you want to be associated with positivity 12 months a year, or as many months a year as possible. And that certainly hasn't been the case. For whatever reason, wherever it goes from here, that certainly hasn't been the case for the last few months.
And as we can both attest, I think that's true even more so in Toronto, where right now, like, you know, the fervent baseball fans are eager. You know what I mean? Like, this is a team that led the American League in attendance last year. Fans came out and said, we want to get behind this team. We want to cheer for baseball. We want to be a baseball city. And, you know, look, tweet anything about the Blue Jays. Just tweet, like, Josh Donaldson's a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. Friggin' 15 to 20 responses, right? Of just, of all across the board of, yeah, Josh Donaldson, of this team sucks, of, you know, Mark Shapiro. Da, da, da. Like, the people are desperate for, it's not, like, it's just not, I just don't think it's that hard. I think there's just some very easy missed opportunities. Like, when I was at the UFC and I ran Josh Donaldson, send a social media person with him and take, you know what I mean? Like, he was hamming it up backstage, giving interviews and stuff. Like, take, you know, send somebody to take some Instagram photos or something, or to, you know, to just follow him around and put it on Snapchat. Like, Aaron Sanchez was at the Raptors game the other night. Marcus Stroman's been at Raptors. Dalton Pompey walked around downtown Toronto and handed out Tim cards to the homeless on his birthday. And the Blue Jays did nothing with that. Could you ask for a more gift wrapped positive PR play?
I think they tweeted about it. On their social
media.
So
you sent what? You retweeted his tweet about it? How did you not send somebody around with him to take photos? You know what I mean? How did you not document that? How did you not, you're talking about one of the most media accessible people. And if he didn't tell you about it, like, do it again. Recreate it. Buy him the Tim cards. It's $50 out of your pocket. Buy him the Tim cards and follow him around. Like, nothing on the internet's real, right? Like, just do it again and create a little video. Like, leverage this. Like, you're owned by a telecommunications company. There's all kinds of, like, social media people that work with the Jays, that work at Rogers, that could facilitate this kind of stuff. Serve your fans in the off season. Keep them interested, because at the end of the day, it that parlays into ticket sales.
Right. And, I think at this point, even if the Jays were to tie a bow on the off season right now, which I don't think either of us expects them to do, but I think even in that scenario, they would draw well next year. But there's the question of, what does that do to the attendances down the road? What does that do to the kind of consensus around the team, the experience that people have cheering for the Blue Jays? And then, of course, what does that do for the product, for the wins and losses? So, and that's ultimately what it comes down to. If you win, people are going to show up. People are going to watch. That's what we've seen the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
And that's the most important variable in all of this. But as you're saying, it's not the only one.
And look, credit to the Blue Jays they're going to go on the winter tour. I think this week, actually, they're going to go out west and they're going to come back to Toronto, and there's going to be an autograph session and this and that. And then, state of the franchise is going to be in early February. I want to say, and then spring training happens. And once spring training happens, I mean, the flood of Toronto media goes down and starts churning out Blue Jays content. Everybody can be happy again. But that's like, you've really compressed your kind of positive news cycle there. Like, you need to spread this out over an off season, especially in an off season when you're saying goodbye to Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista, who are two guys who will likely be on the level of excellence someday, especially in an off season like this. I think, I really do think that the Blue Jays could do some very small incremental things to improve the positive buzz around the team.
Fair enough.
Speaking of Edwin Encarnacion,
yeah,
we have not done one of these since he signed with the Cleveland Indians.
It's crazy, eh?
It is a little crazy, I guess. What's crazy, that we haven't done one, or that he signed with the Cleveland Indians?
Both, actually. Yeah, he must have signed right after we recorded that roundtable.
Yeah, it was like a few days after, I believe. It was like, it was right before Christmas, I believe, was it not? Yeah. So, and we recorded that like 5 days before Christmas or something. He probably signed 3 days. So it's 3 years, $60 million, option for a fourth at 20, $5 million buyout. There's some attendance bonuses in there that John Heyman was reporting, which are kind of interesting. I don't know if those are commonplace in MLB contracts, but I haven't seen them reported publicly before.
No.
So that's interesting.
Although they do have a very long history, particularly in Cleveland. Bob Feller had them. And I think other Cleveland players did as well. So
that's cool.
They're pretty rare, but it actually dates back to like the 40s.
That's a nice way to almost incentivize a player to do more press and to do more appearances.
Sure.
If we're talking about, if I'm here like spouting off about players not, appearing, that's a nice way to kind of incentivize them to be like, hey, get out in the community, get your name out there, help publicize this team. What do you think, Cleveland? What do you think of the deal? What do you think of everything? I know it's been a while, but what's going on?
Yeah, I think that when you look at the terms of that contract and you can, trace back the entire history of the negotiations as Shai Davidi has done on our site. But when you look at it, 60 over 3 would have been a great deal for the Blue Jays.
I agree.
And they end up with Morales on a deal that now, in this new light, looks much worse. So I think that's been covered off well enough. I don't think we need to dwell on that. But other teams missed out too. I mean, you look at the Red Sox, Mitch Moreland at 5.5 when you could have had Encarnacion. And I know they're up against the luxury tax, but man, Encarnacion would be a huge upgrade over Mitch Moreland for Boston. So I think there are other teams that missed out too, or even Texas. What are they going to do at first base? And somehow Cleveland ends up with this awesome deal. I mean, I think this is a phenomenal deal for Cleveland. They already would have been favorites in the Central. Now they're up there with the Red Sox as far as favorites to win the American League pennant. And I just really think that this was opportunistic on Cleveland's part, and I think it's going to pay off. He's a great hitter. I think this is going to be a really good deal for them.
Was this one of the more bizarre free agent case studies that we've seen in recent years, do you think? Or could some of this been predicted?
I certainly didn't predict it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't hear anyone predicting that this could happen. And in fact, when the Indians were linked to Encarnacion at the winter meetings, I dismissed it. I thought there's no way. I mean, at some point I thought someone like the Rangers were going to jump in and make this deal happen at 4x20 or 4x21 or something. And somehow Cleveland ended up with this really good bargain for a player. Yeah, they'll be paying him for his 34, 5, and 6 seasons, but he's proven that he is remarkably consistent as a hitter and productive every single year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't know what will become of Edwin Encarnacion during this contract. He's got to decline at some point. He's 34 now. You know, he's hit basically, you know, between like 35 and 40 home runs every year for like 5 years. You would imagine that can't continue. But I do think that when Edwin Encarnacion is right at the plate, he has a great eye. And I do think it's a bit underrated. And, you know, when you're like, you know, when you're hitting before or after Jose Bautista, you know, who has one of the best eyes I've ever seen, like it's hard to get credit for that. But I do think that Encarnacion doesn't get his due for recognizing good pitches, you know, and also a really great ability, I think, to foul off tough pitches. Like you know, you think about how many times Eddie fouls one straight back, you know, and he like smells his bat, you know, like I think that he has an approach at the plate that can keep him productive for through this contract, I think, certainly.
Yeah, and he's not someone whose value is based on defense and base running. Yeah. So even if he declines as far as foot speed, or I actually don't think he'll decline defensively, because if anything, he's gotten better in the last few years.
Interesting, eh? He's gotten better.
Yeah. Which is rare. Yeah. You know, you don't see that a lot, but I think he's gotten more comfortable at first, and he definitely can handle the position now. But as long as he can kind of hold serve in those areas, then you're looking at a player whose offense is really going to drive a ton of value.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking of, you know, him getting, it's funny to say that he has defensive value when it was like, you know, when Edwin Encarnacion was first a Blue Jay, he was E5, you know, and he was the guy who made a bunch of errors at third base and then carried those struggles in the field to the plate. He was booed at the Rogers Center. He was DFA'd by the Toronto Blue Jays and people were like, good. Get rid of this guy. What a strange history, you know, to turn from that point in your career with the Blue Jays to becoming this guy that fans are absolutely devastated to have lost. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's a different trajectory. And, you know, the same could be said for Bautista when you look at how much he bounced around, a non-tender candidate for the Blue Jays a couple different times before they ultimately were able to benefit from incredible production from Bautista over the years. But it, you know, in contrast to a guy like Carlos Delgado, for example, who was always a top prospect, you knew from the moment that he arrived in the big leagues, well, actually long before he arrived in the big leagues, you knew that he was going to be this incredible power threat. And then boom, that happens. Great. Everyone remembers Delgado. He was an awesome hitter, but these guys almost came out of nowhere. So it's, you know, it's kind of fun in a way to watch that kind of a different trajectory.
Is Edwin a level of excellence guy to you?
100%.
I completely agree.
And Bautista?
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
I think Bautista, undoubtedly. I think Edwin is the guy that you kind of have to make a case for, but I think you can make the case. 999 games, the Blue Jay. How funny is that?
Yeah.
239 home runs, an 878 OPS as a Blue Jay, which includes like some struggles early on. And, you know, I think also just a good member of the team, like just a good person in, you know, around the clubhouse with staff, in the community, with the media, I understand there's a pending lawsuit, but just in all my interactions with him and everything that I've witnessed firsthand, he's been a respectful, kind, genuine human being
for sure,
you know. And I don't know if fans ever truly got to know him, because he was, you know, he was very introverted, and even with the media, you know, you didn't really have a lot of off the record chats with Edwin Encarnacion.
No.
You know, like even you didn't, he always shied away from that. I think he was just kind of a shy guy. You know, he didn't like doing on camera interviews. You know, he was worried about the language, you know, but he spoke fine English.
Yep.
I mean, you could have a decent conversation with him, and I had plenty of good interviews with him, but you know, he never really put himself out there. I don't think he ever wanted the spotlight.
Yeah. And
I kind of remember, sorry to cut you off, but I remember that game where he hit like three home runs. Fans all threw their hats, And then, you know, I remember after the game in the clubhouse, he's sitting in his locker and he's got like these bags of hats. And he almost just kind of looks like bemused. He's just kind of like, I don't know what to do right now. You know, it's like, I feel like he was, I don't know if he's ever really comfortable in the spotlight. So I don't know if fans ever really got a great idea of who he is.
Yeah. And I never got the sense that Encarnacion had agendas that he was trying to deliver through the media, which you'll encounter, whether it's executives or players.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to happen where someone wants a message out there. I never got that sense from Encarnacion.
Even in a walk year, right? In a contract year. And the other thing about Encarnacion is you could ask him about his contract. You could ask him about an error, or like a slump at the plate or an injury or anything. He was never going to get prickly about it. Like, he kind of understood, like, this is part of the game, part of the process is dealing with it, you know, answering questions about it. Like, I never had a negative interaction with him, which I cannot say for several members of the Toronto Blue Jays.
Sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that's the nature of the kind of questions that, you know, we end up asking is that they're not always going to be the types of inquiries that are welcome at a certain moment in time. But yeah, Encarnacion is definitely going to be very warmly received by the Toronto fans when he returns in May. And that's going to be a fun series, you know, watching the kind of reception that he gets here in Toronto.
Yeah, that's going to be surreal, actually. Yeah. That's going to be, that ovation is going to be really, really cool.
Yeah.
These Encarnacion stories are coming back to me. I remember when I was doing a piece on Brett Laurie, back when Brett Laurie was a thing. I remember talking to some people who were saying, like, you know, Edwin Encarnacion has really, and this would have been, I guess, I don't know, 2012, 2013, 2014, whenever, you know, before he was who he is, they were saying, well, he's really kind of trying to take Brett Laurie. He's trying to, I almost said take him under his wing, which would be terrible. He's trying to mentor him. You got that. Yeah. Take him under his wing.
Oh, Jay's pun.
Edwin, come on.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I caught him. I caught myself.
Good.
And then still took us down this road. Anyway, he was kind of mentoring Brett a little bit. And this was at the height of like Brett Laurie's like uncooperativeness, you know, and Edwin was, you know, in the dining hall talking to him about hitting, trying to be a positive influence. I remember when Jimmy Paredes was a Blue Jay for like 45 minutes this year, he was telling me a story about how when he was playing Dominican winter ball, which is like not a glamorous experience at all. Like, no, I've covered winter ball. It's not a good time. Edwin let him like sleep at his house, cooked for him, like gave him a bunch of food, like gave him clothes and stuff, like really helped him out. And this is a guy that he didn't, you know, he knew from like growing up and from around the way, but they weren't like best buds or anything. And he was willing to kind of put himself out for him. So I think he is I don't know if fans really got that sense of Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah. And, you know, he'll now be in a much smaller market. I mean, it might be easier to recede into the background a little bit in Cleveland, although Absolutely. They are defending American League champions. So maybe there'll be a bit more attention on them. I doubt it. I think that for the most part, that team will be in the background basically until October.
We'll see if those attendance bonuses roll in.
I don't think the Cleveland front office is too worried about those.
Yeah, they're for like $2.5 million or something.
Yep.
Good luck in Cleveland. Sorry, 2.5 million fans, not dollars, fans.
That's fans. A lot of fans.
That's what I meant. Yeah, 2.5 million
fans. That's a lot of fans.
Good luck, Cleveland. Speaking of franchise icons departing, Jose Bautista's a free agent. He's basically just, you know, just sailing in the wind. Who wants me? I'm out here. Great hitter, terrific hitter, all coming off a down year, but still a guy who at one point was like a regular, you know, OPS over 1,000 guy. What's going on here?
I don't know. I think that he has the potential to be a really big bargain out there in free agency.
Oh,
I think
that,
you know, when you look at what he does at the plate, even including a down year, relatively speaking, he's such a productive hitter. So I think that he has the potential to be a big producer, and projection systems agree. You talk to people in the game, they expect him to hit in 2017. It's really a question of off-field stuff, for lack of a better term. Where is he going to be and this is not me posing this question, other people with other teams are posing this question.
Yeah.
How is he going to fit in the clubhouse? How do we value the draft pick that we would have to surrender to sign him? And what about the defense? Because defensively, it wasn't pretty last year. So I think those are the questions, but I haven't heard anyone suggest that he can't hit. So that's where I think that, you know, you look at those shortcomings, he's still someone who should be able to provide a lot of value. And I don't know where you stand on this, but when it comes to the whole distraction question, or is he going to be grumpy or pouty in the clubhouse? I actually don't think that, I don't think it would be an overwhelming negative. I think that, you know, any player in the course of a season might go through ups and downs to some extent, but I don't think it would be that big of a deal. I think if he's producing, you're fine.
Yeah, he's certainly a big personality. He's certainly, and I think that should be a factor of your evaluation.
Yeah,
I don't, and
it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm not prepared to dismiss that as a factor.
Yeah.
I found that players generally are pretty polarized on Jose Bautista. I think there's guys that love him and love his influence. I think there's guys that are like, I wish that guy would shut up. I think that's kind of the two ways it goes. But I think that the benefit that you get for, because I've talked to a lot of, you know, young players, and I think I've been public about, you know, Marcus Stroman has talked to me a lot about how much of an influence Jose Bautista was on him. And look, you can look at the way Marcus Stroman's personality is evolving and decide if you think that's a good or bad thing. But I honestly think that as somebody who I generally kind of, you know, side on the desires of the player, and I want players to get paid. I want them to maximize their earning potential. And I want them to do well in this very limited window that they have to, because you never know when an injury or lack of production is going to, you know, take away your ability to do your job and your ability to make money. Look at Jose Bautista, who a year ago, would we have been thinking like this guy would be like basically like floating around in the middle of the ocean with his hand up, like, I'll take a 1-year deal, and people are not giving it to him, right? Like, would we have thought that he would fall, you know, that he would fall off a cliff to this extent? Life comes at you fast in baseball. So I think Jose Bautista is a really positive influence on young players in terms of making money, doing endorsements, you know, like, don't, you know, and I, this might sound a little counterintuitive to my purposes, but don't be too open with the media. Don't be, you know, don't give them everything. What you have, it's valuable what you have. You know what I mean? Like, don't, you know, when the Blue Jays representative comes in and says, hey, sign these 200 bats, maybe say, hey, wait, where are these going? Like, I'm just giving away my signature, which is worth something, you know, like, and it's kind of like a bloodthirsty, like, cold capitalist view of things. But I do think that that is something that more young players need to learn, right? It's kind of like, you know, how we aren't taught like financial literacy in school. It's kind of similar, right? Like, it's kind of young ball player financial literacy in a way. So I think that can be a positive influence. And I agree with you. I think he's going to have a great year at the plate. He still walks a ton. You know, last year, like, he missed a lot of time, but at no point was he not, you know, drawing a lot of walks and seeing a lot of pitches in an at bat, which has an effect, you know, up and down your lineup. It tires the pitcher. You get to see more of his stuff. His stuff gets less effective. I mean, having a guy like that in your lineup, I think, even if, you know, his timing's off at the plate, maybe he's not barreling it the way he wants to, maybe you're seeing a lot of deep fly balls or whatever, even still, I think there's value in that 7-8 pitch at bat that he's giving you. You know, it's like Jose Bautista's outs generally are not coming on the first, second, third pitch of the at bat, generally coming on the 6th, 7th, 8th. So I think that even when he is slumping and not producing, I do think there are other benefits to his approach.
Yeah. And that's, I think, sustainable, because the reason that he draws a lot of walks and has these long at bats is because pitchers don't want to put the ball over the plate to him. And the reason they don't want to put it over the plate is when they do, he's pretty likely to hit it pretty far. So as long as he has that power, and there's no reason to believe, based on what we saw last year, based on what the numbers and projections show, there's no reason to believe that that power has gone anywhere. As long as he has that, he's still going to draw a lot of walks, because he has, as we've talked about, that great plate discipline, that great plate vision. So I think that when you look at all that in combination, you have a great offensive player, potentially, if he's healthy. So that's where I look at him as being a bargain. But I still think that when you look at the Blue Jays and how they're positioned with potentially having 3 early draft picks, I think it's a tough sell. You know, I think that this front office, as we've said before, really values those draft picks, and it would be tough to walk away from getting a 3rd high draft pick in this year's draft.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the draft pick is such a big part of it. And I do also wonder if Jose Bautista being available on a 1-year deal also, like, runs, if it makes it almost more unlikely. Like, I don't know if, are you going to give up the draft pick for 1 year of Jose Bautista when you can't qualify him again?
Sure. I mean, yeah, there's a price where it happens. I mean, the Rangers did that with Desmond.
Like, if I was getting 2 more productive years of Jose Bautista, I would say, okay, like, I can stomach not having the draft pick. But I'm only getting 1 more productive year, and you don't know if he's going to get hurt again. You know what I mean? Like, that makes it harder for me to pass on the draft pick. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think that teams would want a discount price then if they're giving up a draft pick. And that's one of the things that Batista is up against here. And, you know, he's in a tough spot. I expected that the draft pick would be a factor. I'm not sure that I saw it being as much of a factor as it has been. But he's definitely in that position right now where he has to convince teams not only that he can rebound, but that he's going to rebound to such a big extent that it'll be worth surrendering that pick.
I think he's still a right fielder next year. Do you?
I think it depends where he signs. I mean, if you're looking at what he offers, I think that he can play right field. I would be tempted to see if he's willing to play more of a utility role where he goes between left, right, and first base and DH. I don't know how willing he would be to do that, but I think that would be one potential way to make sure you're not overexposing him.
Right. I think that ideally right, first, and DH is where that's, and if you could split his time, you know, somewhat evenly between those three, I think that's an ideal. But I don't think that it's the worst thing in the world for a club if Jose Bautista plays 120, 130 games in right field next year. Carlos Beltran was playing the outfield.
Mark
last
Trumbo.
Year. Mark, right? Like, you know, I've seen Danny Valencia play the outfield. You know, like, let's, like, it's not exactly a crippling thing. And I don't think that his defense was as bad as, I think there were some very glaring gaffes. But I don't think that is, you know, I haven't done this yet, but Baseball Savant's got all these cool new fielding tools that I've been playing around with. And for whatever reason, I haven't done it with Jose Bautista. So I'd be interested to look at like his starting point and the amount of balls that he's getting to. But you can make the argument that in Toronto, with Kevin Pillar in center field, you don't need as, you know, adept of a defensive right or left fielder because your center fielder gets to everything.
So you think, what's your read on the Jays and all this? Do you think that
no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
No, I don't. It would have happened already. There's no reason for it not to have happened already if it was going to happen.
They could be waiting them out, trying to see if that price lowers a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Minnesota Twins are checking in for Pete's sake. You know, like let's at some point be serious about it, right? And I think that was a lot of people's frustrations with, you know, the Blue Jays and Edwin Encarnacion talks, is that they didn't just get it done. They didn't just go get them, you know, like, or you could make that case on both sides. But at some point, just be serious and get it done so we can all move on. I don't know if the waiting game or, you know, playing hardball with them is necessarily, in the wake of the Encarnacion negotiations, is necessarily the best strategy here.
Although I think it's something that MLB front offices are very comfortable doing. I mean, even if you look around at the Rangers, they're playing the waiting game with Napoli and others. And you look at the Orioles, and aside from acquiring Seth Smith, they've really played the waiting game too. I mean, you could list any number of teams, the Rays until they signed Colby Rasmus. Like, it's been a slow progressing offseason across baseball because I think executives, aside from Dave Dombrowski, are generally willing to say, all right, we're just going to wait this out. We're going to see where this goes. And if that allows the price to drop a little bit as players get closer to spring training, then they'll welcome that discount.
Do you think Jose Bautista, and this is probably an unfair question to ask you, but do you think Jose Bautista would be okay with going into spring training without a deal?
Whether it's Bautista or someone else, we are going to have players without contracts.
It kind of seems like we have to.
Yeah.
With the amount of names that are still out there, right?
We're going to have guys who aren't signed in spring training. And there comes a point where you actually might want to wait a couple weeks and see if, you know, not to be too vulture-ish, you know, you might see if there's an injury, because in the past that's happened.
Yeah.
And we've seen guys sign in spring, in season. Morales did it. I mean, that was an extreme way to get around the draft pick compensation, but we've seen guys play the waiting game more and more.
Man, when did Dexter Fowler sign last year?
That was in spring training.
Yeah, it was in spring training, right? I mean, arguably, if you get to the beginning of spring training without a deal, it's almost to your benefit to just wait as long as you can into spring training for either somebody to get hurt or somebody to perform so poorly that a team says, we need something better.
Yeah. And it depends on what kind of player you are, where you are in your career, how many reps you feel you need as a player to get ready for the season. You know, if you're like in Encarnacion's case, he only ever seemed to really need about 10 spring training games anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, if he was still out there, you could make the case, all right, well, wait it out. He's going to be, you know, have him look at a few bullpen sessions and he'll be fine. He'll still go out there and hit you his 40 home runs.
We're going to step away, take a break, and then we will come back and tie up some odds and ends from Blue Jays land as we continue on At the Letters.
And the payoff to Mazzara. Struck him out. 1-2, and Gomez strikes. Back-to-back strikeouts for Aaron Sanchez. The young right-hander deals. And a swing and a miss. He struck him out. Strikes out the side.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet.ca, iTunes. Our producer is Sam McKee, at Sam A. McKee on Twitter. Get at him with music requests if you have any. If you're using this podcast, listen to music. I don't know. Ben's on Twitter, at B. Nicholson-Smith. Ben also co-authored recently a very good piece on Sportsnet.ca called Shorting the Long Ball, co-authored with Shai Davidi, who I have a feeling you may have heard of, just about, you know, just what the hell is happening right now, because you've got two home run kings still on the market, and teams seem to be valuing the home run a lot different than they once did.
Yeah, it seems like the home run has increasingly become a means to an end as opposed to an end in itself. And I think that for a long time, if you were a slugger who would hit 40 homers the way Chris Carter did last year, you were assured not only of having a job.
Might not get non-tendered.
Yeah, exactly. You would not get non-tendered. You would have a job and you would probably be very coveted. And I think that's changing because people are seeing that there are other ways to create value on a baseball field besides hitting home runs. And another wrinkle in this is that there are tons of guys who hit home runs now. So you look around baseball last year, there were 111 players who hit 20 homers. So that's a lot. That's almost four per team. And if you have a lot of guys hitting 20 homers, then maybe the 30-homer guy who does nothing on defense and who does nothing on the base paths just isn't that appealing to you. And I think that's what we're seeing with guys like Pedro Alvarez, Brandon Moss, Mark Trumbo. If you have so-called empty power, you might be in a tough spot in this market.
Last year was the most home runs hit in how long?
Since 2000. And it was the second most all-time.
That's crazy. The second most all, like, of any era.
Any era.
That's unbelievable, I think, right?
Yeah.
Like, even like you think about the steroid era and how like balls were flying out of the parks, and last year was the second highest all time.
Right. So then you look at Trumbo hitting 47, and that's impressive, but everyone has home run hitters. There's not some team out there that's just desperate for some kind of home run power.
Do you think the pitching league wide is in a bit of a dip, or do you think hitters are just better? Or is it probably a combination?
I think the pitching's good. I think pitching.
Right? Because you've got like guys who are throwing harder than ever before. Their breaking stuff is nastier than ever before.
They're only pitching when they're at full strength, too. I mean, you don't see guys pitching 8-9 innings at a time. It's generally shorter bursts. So I think pitching is good. We haven't had expansion in, you know, almost 20 years. So I think that it's just that the game has become geared toward, you know, the three true outcomes. You see a lot of strikeouts, a lot of walks, a lot of home runs. It's not necessarily good for the game. Right. In fact, I would make the case that it's much more fun to watch singles and double plays and doubles and outfielders chasing balls down in the gap. It's just not the way the game is right now.
You will never get me to concede that home runs are not fun.
Oh, home runs are amazing.
Home runs are great.
Oh, 100%. They're amazing.
Love me a home run.
Right. But then they come with strikeouts is kind of the counterpoint to that. Because if you're swinging that hard, you're probably going to miss more often.
I think strikeouts are kind of cool too. I like a good strikeout. Like a good Marco Estrada guy like fishes for that changeup strikeout. I'm a fan of that. Or Marcus Stroman like sets a guy up with a couple two-seamers and then flips in a nice curve. Like I like that.
I'm with you. And I think that probably our listeners are too, because they're, you know, almost by definition, if you're seeking out a baseball podcast in January, you're probably a huge baseball fan.
You're probably insane.
Yeah. I mean, it's safe to say that, you know, our listeners, I'm sure, love strikeouts. And, you know, watching Aaron Sanchez overpower someone with a sinker at the toes, you know, that's great. Okay. But, you know, I think that for casual fans, for, you know, Joe Raptor fan who's tuning into a couple Jays games a year, maybe that's not quite as fun as watching, you know, watching a double or a single or a double play.
But the casual fan also probably enjoys the home runs more than, you know what I mean, more than the small ball.
Everyone loves home runs.
So then you can't have home runs without strikeouts. They kind of come hand in hand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not proposing some sort of alternate, you know, there's no going back at this point. This is the way the game is. But
give them four strikes.
Yeah, because baseball, of all sports, is just going to...
make it longer.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, anyway, it's a fun topic. Check it out. I think that home runs obviously are insanely valuable still. It's just that the way they're valued in relation to other skills has changed. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think you just have to do other stuff. Like Mark Trumbo had like a 315 OBP last year or something.
Being generous.
Right? Yeah, right? Yeah, maybe like closer to 300. Sure, he hit 47 bombs, but... you know, you're making outs the rest of the time, and that's not good. Shorting the long ball, sportsnet.ca. Look it up. We'll link to it in the post. Hey, Gavin Floyd's back. Minor league deal with the Blue Jays. Little bullpen depth, maybe even starting depth, question mark. I think he gets $1 million if he makes the club, which is what he made last year, and he gave the Blue Jays great value on $1 million last year. You know, he ended up with a 4.06 ERA. I mean, he went through, a pretty significant slump at one point, but he was also really good at others until he got hurt with a lat injury in June and was never heard from again. But he was a decent bullpen piece, still has a live arm, still throws really hard. Like, he was 95, 96 last year. His break, guys love his curveball. They say his breaking stuff is great. Can't argue with this.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't hurt in the least to have an extra arm. This is the kind of arm that the Jays need. They're pretty thin beyond that front five in the rotation. And I think that Floyd is someone, when healthy, who can really help. I mean, I don't know that there's any kind of guarantee that he's going to be healthy, but if he is, and doesn't hurt to take him to spring training and see how he feels, then he's someone who absolutely can help. And if they get 30 innings like they did last year, even if they get 15 innings from him, great. Then, you know, you pay him when he's in the big leagues, you get 15 innings, and you're going to need a lot of guys in the course of the year. He can be one of them.
Give me 1/8 of a win, please, Gavin Floyd, because that's all you're being paid for.
Right.
Anything else is bonus.
Right.
A win is about $8 million. Some will tell you it's 10. I'm going to go with 8. You're getting $1 million. Give me 1/8 of a win, and then the rest is just surplus value, baby. And I think that it looks... I think it makes more sense just considering that I think Joe Biagini has to be a part of this bullpen, at least as presently constructed. I think he has to be in the bullpen. So it's nice to have another guy who can give you length, who could start in a pinch, who has had success as a starter, who has a starter's repertoire. I think it's nice to have that as some insurance because the Blue Jays certainly don't have a lot of starting pitching depth. Joe Biagini was really like the number six looking at going in next year. And I think you just need him in the bullpen.
Mike Bolsinger. Is the right. Only other name, really.
I always forget about Mike Bolsinger.
Yeah.
Other than when he tweets at us. But like, other than that, I always forget about him. Yeah, he's around too, yeah.
That's the extent of it, you know, and they're going to need much more than that. So I think that the Blue Jays should make more additions along those lines.
Absolutely. What else we got? We got arbitration coming up. Highly exciting. The Blue Jays have 4 players going through. Marcus Stroman, Darwin Barney, Ezekiel Carrera, and Aaron Loop. Let's start with Loop. I would have thought at certain points last year he was a non-tender candidate. Now, as we just said, with the state of this bullpen, with there being 0 left-handed relief depth, I think you have to bring back Aaron Loop.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's why they kept him around, and he's not going to get really much of a raise. But as it stands right now, number one lefty in the bullpen.
MLB Trade Rumors has him at $1.2 million. Ezekiel Carrera also at $1.2 million. Those are reasonable contracts for those guys. Can't argue with the Blue Jays going down that road. Darwin Barney's at $1.6 million. What do you think about him? I mean, there's still a bit of like kind of that utility infield logjam with him and Ryan Goins. I don't know if Goins has options this year.
It's a good question.
I'm going to quickly look that up while you tell me about Darwin Barney and his $1.6 million projection.
Yeah, I think that it could be a little higher than that in the end because he signed his most recent deal outside of the arbitration system. But long story short, he's going to be a useful piece. We saw last year how useful he can be, and he'll be making bench player money. So it's 100% understandable to bring him back.
I believe Ryan Goins is out of options. Just quickly looking at the baseball reference here, I don't think he has options because I'm seeing like 1, 2, 3, 4 years even where he's gone up and down.
We'll have to dig on this.
So if Ryan Goins doesn't have options, and Darwin Barney's in here at $1.6 million, Ryan Goins will be making league minimum. I mean, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if you had to expose one of them, I guess. I don't know. That's kind of something to keep an eye on, maybe, because I don't know. One of those guys is going to have to be exposed.
Yeah.
To waivers, it seems. No?
That's the way it looks. Assuming that Goins is out of options, then to put him in the minors, then you'd have to
And I don't know if a team's going to, you know, jump at Ryan Goins, who, you know, obviously can't hit terrifically, but he is a great, you know, a great glove, a great defensive infielder. Maybe he fits a bit better on a National League team.
Bigger bench.
I don't, maybe that's, we're really in the offseason now where we're talking about Ryan Goins possibly getting picked up on waivers, but I don't think that's so far out of the realm of possibility that a team would, you know, a National League team would take a flyer on a guy like that.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I mean, this is why I think it's still in a good position because injuries happen and you never know. So it helps to have that depth. But yeah, I think really for the Jays, the most interesting case is Stroman, positioned to get a pretty big raise. I mean, $3.5 million is what Trade Rumors has him at. And
this is a guy who lost an entire season too.
Right. And that's the one knock against him.
But it would be even higher if he had pitched that year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you look at a guy who put together 200 innings in his platform season. That's great. Playoff success too. I mean, that's really not the core of what an arbitration case is going to be. But then you look at how the Jays use Stroman this year. You could say, okay, he had a 4.37 ERA. So on the one hand, it's not great. It's basically a league average ERA. But he was their opening day starter. He was the guy that they went to in a must-win wildcard game.
Yeah.
A game that they won. And then they kept going to him in the playoffs. So I think that if you're the Jays, you'd have to be very careful if this were to go to a hearing about arguing that Stroman had a mediocre year. Because there's the easy retort on Stroman's side. Well, if I was so mediocre, why was I your opening day starter? Why was I the guy that you went to when you needed a must-win game? So I think that ultimately, it probably won't come down to that, and it'll just be crunching numbers, comparing to guys like Nathan Eovaldi, Tom Kohler, Garrett Richards. Those would be the types of names that come up as comparisons for Stroman. And I would expect that he probably ends up somewhere around that $3.5 million projection. Eovaldi was at 3.3 when he went through the system a couple of years ago, so there's a strong comparison. He had the exact same ERA that year, so it could end up being in that range, but either way, Stroman positioned to get a really big raise.
And he had a really strong end to the season last year. You mentioned the playoff success, and then in his final 2 months, August and September, 11 starts, 3.28 ERA.
Yeah, and that helps.
Right? That's the most recent data that you have, and it speaks very, very fondly of him.
Yeah, and it kind of makes up for the fact that he only made 4 regular season starts in 2015. But again, if you're Stroman, you can point to the fact that he wasn't even supposed to make those 4 starts, that he pushed through injury and was able to get back there and help the team out as they made through the playoffs. So, I mean, that's definitely a point in his favor. Ultimately, these things come down to how many bulk innings do you have? What's your ERA? Stroman's 24-16 lifetime, which helps him because wins do still matter in arbitration. So he has that to point to as well. And For those reasons, he's going to set himself up pretty nicely in what's going to be the first of 4 trips through arbitration.
Hey, if he's got, if he needs some documents, some supporting evidence to file at his arbitration case, there's a piece on sportsnet.ca that I think he could probably throw in there.
You are joking, but, that kind of thing can come up. You know, if it's, not necessarily like a column, but quotes from the team about the player, that kind of thing can come up in a hearing if it gets that far. So it's
ball players, give a guy like me access, and you make money.
Yeah, exactly.
It's great.
Arden Zwelling, the key to winning your arbitration case.
Exactly. You mentioned briefly he is a Super 2, so he's going to go through arbitration 4 times. Blue Jays still have control over him, for 4 years. We'll see next year, I think how he does next year will really say a lot about whether the Blue Jays will just continue going to arbitration with him or trying to go 1-year contracts, or whether they have to start looking at a long-term agreement with him because the arbitration numbers are going to get a bit unpalatable.
Yeah. And I think that with both him and Aaron Sanchez, there's a very strong case to be made for talking extension with these guys pretty soon.
Well, if you're going to talk extension with Aaron Sanchez, you're going to be talking to a man by the name of Scott Boras,
yes,
who is somebody that I'm sure people have heard of. It's interesting to me, the whole the aura around Scott Boras, because if you asked 100 baseball fans to name an MLB agent, I bet you 95 of them say Scott Boras, maybe even 99 of them, right? Like, because one guy's buddies with somebody or something, right? I mean, you know of him because he is so out there in the spotlight, because he gives interviews, because he's very opinionated, because he's not afraid to make statements and argue on behalf of his players through the media. Like, he makes himself a part of it, and that's part of his strategy. So that's why you know of him. It's not like he is the greatest baseball agent of all time. There's a lot of really good agents in baseball.
If he's not, who is?
I don't know. I don't have a ranking prepared.
I think he is the greatest baseball agent.
Oh, all right. Interesting.
Yeah.
I would argue that because I don't know how you substantiate that, but I think that the case I'm trying to make is that you know his name because he's out there in the public eye a lot more than other agents. There's a lot of good agents in baseball.
Yes.
So what I'm trying to pour cold water on is that, you know, the kind of doom and gloom, like Blue Jays fan thing of this is the end of Aaron Sanchez. Oh, great. He's going to leave for sure. This and that. Like, it doesn't matter who Aaron Sanchez's agent is. If he continues to build on a platform of I led the American League in ERA last year, even if he just remains consistent for the next few years, he's going to get a really big deal. There's no way that you're getting Aaron Sanchez on the cheap. I mean, this is one of the most exciting young arms in baseball. So like, it doesn't matter who his agent is at that, but nobody, you couldn't screw that up, listener. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, no, I think that the greater effect of this will be just how the Blue Jays interact with Scott Boras in terms of his use and his workload and his arm.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think that as you said before, Sanchez, if he keeps this up, is going to get paid.
Yes.
And, you know, his previous agents were not about to gift wrap the Blue Jays some sort of team friendly extension. You don't really see that as much as you used to 5-6 years ago when the Ricky Romeros and John Lesters of the world would sign these template, you know, $30 million extensions. It's not really the way the Players Association operates these days. And it's not the way that big time agencies operate. And Sanchez's previous agency, Legacy, was not some mom and pop shop. So I think that there was never going to be some sort of a extreme bargain on Sanchez. This certainly reinforces that idea. I think it probably is suggestive that Sanchez is not going to sign a team-friendly extension unless the Blue Jays are really aggressive on the money front. But, you know, ultimately, they still have 4 years of a player who's emerging as one of the best young pitchers in baseball.
It's funny to talk about the Ricky Romero extension as team-friendly. When it was signed, it was. Ultimately, very much not so. But that is kind of the delicate balance with signing an extension at that point in your career, is you are guarding against injury, against a dramatic decrease in effectiveness and things like that. That's why you would, you know, sign something like that. But I think Aaron Sanchez is certainly somebody who's going to bet on himself. I think Scott Boras is certainly an agent who is going to encourage him to do so. And so I don't know. This is so far, like, he hasn't even hit arbitration yet. There's 4 more years until he would be a free agent. And another year before you have to even start about, you'll start thinking about arbitration numbers and stuff like that. But if Aaron Sanchez does have another year this season like he had last year, we were talking, you know, a 3 ERA, 200 innings pitched, he's going to be due for a pretty good raise.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you talk about Stroman this year ending up around, you know, let's say for argument's sake, the projection is accurate and he ends up at 3.5.
Yeah.
Sanchez would do much better than that if he were able to replicate his 2016 numbers. But that's fine. That's, you know, that's still a bargain for what he is. And I agree with your other point that the interesting wrinkle in this is how the innings work, because Boras has had Strasburg and he has had Matt Harvey.
Yeah.
And he was outspoken on both fronts. Once, very much in support of what the Nationals were doing. The other time, very much against what the Mets were doing. So, you know, it's definitely a dynamic worth watching very closely. And I'm sure that, you know, given Boras and who he is and how he operates, we're going to hear about this. You know, it's not going to be in the background quietly, you know, over some really secret text message exchange. This is going to be front and center because Boras sometimes does negotiate through the media.
No one ever says, I wonder what Scott Boras thinks about this.
Well, I do now, but I don't think we're going to have to wonder for long.
And it is interesting with Aaron Sanchez because the innings and the arm and fatigue and all that was such a topic for him last year. And he ended up getting to 192 in the regular season, plus, as I quickly look it up here, 11 and two-thirds in the... So he went well over 200 regular season, postseason combined. You know, a pretty decent platform, but it will be interesting to see how Scott Boras, you know, feels about that and what he thinks Aaron Sanchez should do going forward. You know, it's, again, it's a balance because you can't get paid if you're not on the field. right? So you have to pitch and you have to put up numbers. And so, you know, you can't be skipping starts every other week, right? Like you have to perform in order to get paid. But I think this is great for Aaron Sanchez signing with Scott Boras, obviously, because you've got an agent who's proven to maximize, you know, the amount of value that you get, who takes a very, as we've been saying, a very keen interest in your health and you know, your durability and your longevity in this game. I think that's exactly what you want as a player. I think it's great for the player. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And then also, and I don't think this is that big of a factor, but I do think we should at least mention it. The Blue Jays and Scott Boras haven't always had the greatest relationship. It's actually been quite tumultuous. Yeah. That was under a previous regime. I think a lot of that had to do with Paul Beeston.
Yep.
But this is kind of the first high-profile Scott Boras agent the Blue Jays have had since I cannot even remember.
Brad Wilkerson, Scott Schoenweiss. Yeah. I mean, that's a long time ago. They essentially went through the entire Alex Anthopoulos era without having a prominent Scott Boras client. And so that's a long time. And even now, I mean, they had Frankie Money last year, and that was, you know, that was a mini chapter in the Blue Jays Boras history. But this is so much more significant than Morales or Michael Bourne or any of those smaller Boras deals that they signed. I guess it was last spring.
Yeah, it's gonna be fascinating to watch it play out.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Well,
here on the old ETL,
I guess I'll ask you. What do you like next week? Do you think that we'll have some moves to discuss, or do you think that this thing drags out a little longer?
Man, how much longer can it drag?
5 weeks, man. And then you got spring training.
Jeez. Yeah, that's what's kind of weird about this, is that we're like starting to talk about spring training plans and stuff like that. And it's like, we don't even know who's going to be playing the outfield for the team.
Nope.
So, and there's just, you just look at some of the names that are still out there. I wonder if there's still trades to happen.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
I wonder if the Blue Jays are still looking at some trades, you know?
I would think so.
You know, you always wonder about a new regime that comes in under a previous regime's, with a previous regime's farm system, and how the new regime feels about those players, right? So, you know, while, you know, if, you know, Alex Anthopoulos and you know, the everybody who was here before, they drafted Connor Green, they signed Vlad Guerrero, they, you know, Sean Reed Foley, all these guys, right? The guys that, you know, Richard Urania, the guys at the top of the prospects list, obviously they felt strongly about them because they selected them, they developed them, they've worked with them. The new regime, you know, they would have scouted these players when they were, you know, in other organizations. You know, if you're Gil Kim, you would have scouted these players when you were in Texas. If you're, you know, Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins, when you were in Cleveland, you would have scouted these players. You have your own views on them, and now you have a year's worth of knowledge of working with them and understanding them. You wonder if they feel differently about those players and maybe are more willing to trade them.
Yeah, and I would think some guys, they're probably much more willing to trade. And other guys, they've watched have breakout seasons, whether it's a Sean Reed Foley, or, you know, you could look at Rowdy Tellez having continued success at Double A. Those guys, they might be less likely to trade, but I'm sure that there are guys who fit that description for whatever reason, whether it's the advanced metrics that they have, whether it's something as simple as health, whether it's character. All these different things can combine to make a player someone that you're more than happy to trade away.
As always in life, perception is everything. So if, you know, if a rival team perceives, you know, like I was saying, if a National League team perceives Ryan Goins as a great bench piece, they might go get him. You know, like it really depends how other teams feel about your guys and how you feel about them. You know, it's, these things can shift and change.
That's our blockbuster next week. Man. Goins to the Padres. Heard it here first.
Andrew McCutchen for Vlad Guerrero Jr.
I don't think that's enough.
Heard that floated. I don't think it's enough either, but I think it gets you a discussion.
Yeah.
Vlad
Jr. can get a discussion going about just about anyone, I would think. I you know, if you're the Pirates, I don't know if you're trading for a 17-year-old for your franchise player. In fact, I think you're not. I think you need more, and I don't know if the Jays have or would want to give that up.
Right. Yeah, I don't know either, you know, and I wonder how Blue Jays fans would feel about the idea of trading Vladimir Guerrero Jr. if his name was like Vladimir Conway. If he was Vladimir Smith, I wonder if that would change things. You know what I mean? Like, those bloodlines do, it does affect people's perception in a way. Not that I'm advocating for trading Vladimir Guerrero Jr. He's a very, very talented young prospect, front of Baseball America. You don't get on the cover of Baseball America if you're not very well and highly regarded. But I bet you there was a day, once upon a time, I cannot confirm this, but I bet you there was a day when Justin Smoke was on the front of Baseball America, on the cover. Justin Smoke was one of the highest regarded prospects in the game at one time. Dominic Brown, same thing.
Melvin Upton Jr. was almost certainly on the cover.
Melvin Upton Jr., Jesus Montero, one of the most highly regarded prospects, traded for like Cliff Lee, and or Smoke was traded for Cliff Lee. I don't know. These guys were involved in blockbuster deals. These guys were thought to be the future of the game. And Montero, Smoke, who's the other guy I mentioned? Dom Brown. Those were all guys who were in the Blue Jays system last year and who I had very, very little contribution to the Blue Jays making the ALCS.
But prospects still are very valuable.
Absolutely. They're valuable. But you can't, there's no guarantee that they will turn into. I think the players that are most valuable are the players that have proven they can produce at the major league level.
Yep.
Adam Eaton. That is a very valuable player.
Exactly.
That's what, you know what I mean? So I you know, I've ranted about this before.
Yeah.
You got to be careful with the prospects. You got
to
be careful.
Yeah, you have to be. But even if you know that there's a good chance they fail, you can assign a likelihood of that failure and say, okay, well, even if he's 50% likely to fail, if he succeeds, it's so huge for the franchise that you still want to hold on to him.
Right. I think especially when you're trading for, this kind of ties back into the draft pick thing, where how highly the Blue Jays value that first round draft pick. That's the most valuable commodity in the game, I think. Aside from like a Mike Trout or whatever, like a first round draft pick is so valuable because you get to pick your guy. Chances are your guy's still going to be on the board and you get to groom him and develop him into what you want him to be. You know what I mean? You get to, you take over this guy's life. You say, yeah, is that how you hit? No, you hit this way now. Oh, is that how you were eating? No, you eat our stuff now. You know what I mean? You get 8 hours of sleep with a Fitbit now. You know, you do this and that, right? Like you get to really mold them into what you want them to be. And if they don't work out, look, they don't work out. But if they have good perceived value, you can move them. I think when you're trading for other teams' prospects, you're never completely sure, completely certain what you're getting. As we've seen, teams can, you know, gussy up the medical records and stuff like that. And, you know, you can get unreliable reports on a guy's makeup or whatever. You know, you're depending on a scout's eyes a lot of the time. So you better trust your scouting department.
Yeah, and I know we're wrapping up here, but just to your point on the draft.
Yeah.
For 40 years, we've looked at the draft as this really uncertain way of acquiring talent, where there's all kinds of room for error, and you're just as likely to draft Brian Taylor first overall as you are Alex Rodriguez. But I think that increasingly that's probably going to change. And this is just a theory. This isn't even based in anything. But I would bet that when we're looking back at the next 10 draft classes, teams are probably going to get a lot better at finding players who deliver talent. And I think they're going to take fewer risks on guys who aren't going to pan out.
I think teams are getting better at developing talent.
And that's a good point too.
That's what I think is getting better, is teams are getting better at getting the most out of talented young athletes. Because I think there's always been really talented athletes that have been funneled through the draft system into baseball. But then you get them into the minor leagues and it's like seen as like a rite of passage that guys stay up all night on the bus, you know, riding around, and that guys, you know, sit on like, you know, terrible wooden benches or like play in these, you know, awful facilities or whatever. It's like, pay your dues, man. You know, everybody went through that. And guys get in the gym and they're just like doing curls for the girls kind of stuff, right? And they're doing like prison workouts and, you know, they're not eating right. You know, like I think the teams are getting better at, you know, with the Blue Jays high performance department is a great example. Teams are getting better at developing that talent. So I think that's why you'll see a lot better players coming out of the first round going forward, because I think teams are being, and even like managing innings, managing arms, you know, teams are still learning a lot about this stuff through biomechanics, through, you know, how players are responding, through fatigue. It's not just like a go throw your bullpen. Sorry, you're sore. You're hanging. I don't want to hear it. Go throw the bullpen. You know, like I think the teams are just getting better at that kind of stuff. I think that's why you'll, you know, to your point, see a lot of, but you know, a lot more first round talent becoming productive MLB players.
Agreed. Who says there's no baseball to talk about on January 11th?
Crushed this podcast. Look at Sam. Sam's like, keep going. Is that what that motion means? That motion means keep going?
I think it means wrap it up.
Thank you to Sam McKee for producing. Thank you to Ben Nixon Smith, Twitter at BNixon Smith. Sam McKee on Twitter at Sam A. McKee. Thank you to listeners for coming along with us on this journey on a very dead week in Blue Jays land. We'll be back. Maybe something happens. Maybe even if something doesn't. We'll be back. Thank you as always for listening. This has been At The Letter.